pragmatists in our actions. Let us work together in the name of turning Ukraine into an independent, thriving and democratic state, in the name of strategic partnership between our nations for the benefit of stability in Europe. Yours sincerely, Yuri Shcherbak, Ambassador of Ukraine. So, Mr. Talbot, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Yaroslav, very much. My friend Yuri Shcherbak has delivered a better speech than the one I'm about to give, and he's not even here. But I do want to thank him, despite the fact that he's not able to be with us tonight, my friend Mr. Kuczynski, and also my sympathies to Mr. Kuczynski and to Yaroslav and George and to the Washington group for including me in your celebration. I know that some of you here this evening have come from out of town. You've come from other parts of the country to take part in what promises to be a very stimulating and important and thoughtful conference. To those of you who are coming from out of town, I want to say welcome to Washington. Now, during the Cold War, this city was often called the capital of the free world. Washington still qualifies as exactly that today. In fact, with the collapse of Soviet communism, with the disappearance of the USSR, and with the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, the free world not only still exists, it's a much bigger place today than it was just a few years ago. And today, the free world includes an independent, democratic Ukraine. Over the past 3.5 years, I've had 6 opportunities to visit that brave young democracy. It's good to be back this evening on sovereign Ukrainian territory. And I'm grateful to the embassy for opening its doors, not just to me, but to my colleagues from the administration. John Deutsch gets applauded just for coming a few blocks to be on sovereign Ukrainian territory. Imagine the reception you will get, John, when you go to Kyiv for the first time. Also, my friend and colleague, Milan Verveer, from the office of the First Lady, who educated me a little bit on both Ukrainian history and on the Ukrainian language when we were together in Kyiv not too long ago. And Taras Vasilyuk of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, and Bill Taylor and Bruce Konik of the State Department, and Carlos Pascual of the National Security Council. These are just a few of the members of the team that works in the executive branch on U.S.-Ukrainian relations. President Clinton and Secretary of State Christopher have asked me this evening to convey 2 messages to all of you. First, they've asked me to extend their thanks for all that everyone here has done both for Ukraine and also for U.S.-Ukrainian relations. And second, they've asked me to review briefly, from the vantage point of the Clinton administration, the past 5 years. Everyone here tonight knows very well how far Ukraine has come in that short period of time. This room is filled with witnesses of the transformation that George spoke of in his opening remarks. Some of you here this evening were part of the chain of unity that stretched from Kyiv to Lviv on January 22, 1990. Some of you were in the Verkhovna Rada on August 24, 1991, the day when an honor guard brought in a giant blue and green flag and Ukraine declared its independence. Others here were in Kyiv or Lviv or Kharkiv during the landmark presidential election in 1994 when Ukraine became the first new independent state of the former Soviet Union to transfer power from one democratically elected government to another. Or you've been back for subsequent regional elections that have produced victories around the country for a new generation of leaders who have made the cities and towns they lead into hubs of reform and sources of new ideas and new hope for the future. Or maybe you were there this past June when Ukraine adopted a new constitution that has codified the country's commitment to democracy and equal rights for all of its citizens. Many of you, I guess most of you, have seen with your own eyes the industry and entrepreneurship of the Ukrainian people, which have spawned thousands of small businesses throughout the country. Those small businesses now account for more than half of Ukraine's national income. You've seen the hospitals, where there are now MRIs and other modern diagnostic equipment, and you've seen the maternity wards, where there are now, for the first time, incubators for premature babies. You've seen the churches and the synagogues that are once again filled with worshipers. In fact, many of you here this evening have been more than just witnesses of all this. You've been benefactors and participants in the process. And your contribution goes back a lot longer than just 5 years. For more than seven decades, the Ukrainian American community kept alive the dream of an independent and democratic homeland. Your faith nurtured the spirit and the substance of independence until the dream finally came true in 1991. Since then, you've labored on behalf of Ukrainian democracy, Ukrainian rule of law, Ukrainian freedom of the press, Ukrainian medicine and science, the Ukrainian environment, and Ukrainian prosperity. Many of you have worked especially hard to put the Ukrainian economy on the right track. We all realize that that has been a monumental effort, and there have been some scary moments along the way. Not too long ago, Ukraine was looking over the edge of the abyss of hyperinflation. Yet last month, inflation was running at only 2%, which is a huge and very hopeful improvement. In September, Ukraine successfully launched its new currency, the hryvnia, which is already stronger than the harbovanets, the provisional currency that it replaced. If Ukraine is to continue this progress, if it's to fulfill its tremendous economic potential, there's much hard work still to be done. That means cutting taxes and bureaucracy, promoting land reform, and building the legal foundation for a market economy. But Ukraine does not face that challenge alone. The American people as a whole have followed the example of the Ukrainian American community, which is to say, we've all joined together in the great task of supporting a free and prosperous and democratic Ukraine. President Clinton has led the way. He's done so by calling on the international community to secure $1.9 billion in cash commitments for Ukraine in 1996. He's gone beyond the mandates of Congress to provide Ukraine with $330 million in bilateral grants and $860 million in trade and investment credits. We're in Ukraine not just with our dollars, but also with our know-how, our expertise, our can-do bent for licking the toughest problems. We're on the ground making a difference for the better, working with real people. Americans are in Ukraine today training the next generation of entrepreneurs. And by the way, our exchange programs work both ways. Through the U.S. Information Agency and the Agency for International Development, nearly 8,000 Ukrainians have come to our country to share our ideas and to learn firsthand about our way of life and work. By early next year, we will have helped Ukraine privatize virtually its entire small business sector and also a significant share of its larger enterprises. We've already helped Ukraine build democracy by sponsoring town hall meetings and sending legal advisors and constitutional experts and assisting Ukraine's growing independent media. Let me also make special mention of America's efforts, both public and private, to help Ukraine deal with one of the defining disasters of our time. 10 years ago, an obscure town on the Pripyat River became world famous overnight. When reactor number 4 at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant blew its top, it was more than an isolated accident. It marked the beginning of the meltdown of the Soviet Union itself. But Chernobyl also left Ukraine with a health crisis that will last a generation. And it left the world with an obligation to ensure that such a tragedy never happens again. Through the work of numerous volunteer groups, many of whom are represented in this audience, there's been an outpouring of support for the victims, and especially the children of Chernobyl. A number of you, I believe, were present at the White House when Vice President Gore and the First Lady commemorated the anniversary of the disaster, not just by looking backward in horror and in compassion, but by looking forward with hope and resolve. In this spirit, the United States has delivered over 100 tons of medical supplies to hospitals in Ukraine and Belarus. We've also used our leadership position in the group of seven major industrialized democracies to make available $3 billion to support Ukraine's decision, its very courageous decision, to close Chernobyl by the year 2000. Let me assert a key point here. Everything that we've done for Ukraine and everything that we will do in the future, we do not just because we Americans are a generous people, although that is certainly the case. We've done it and will keep on doing it also because it's in our own nation's interest to see an independent, secure, democratic Ukraine survive, succeed, and prosper. Let me explain why that is by quoting our president. I was with him, as of course was Marta, on a lovely spring day in May 1995, when he spoke to an audience of enthusiastic, welcoming students in front of the main building at Shevchenko University in Kyiv. President Clinton told that young audience that support for Ukraine's young democracy reflects our most deeply held American values and advances our most fundamental interests. He said a Ukraine that fulfills the hopes of its 52 million citizens will also, as he put it, and I'm quoting, provide an essential anchor of stability and freedom in a part of the world that is still reeling from rapid change. We have said over and over again, and we mean it every time we say it, that Ukraine is a key European country. It is a bellwether for a vast region that matters deeply and enduringly to the United States. If Ukraine stays on course toward a better future for its own people, that will be good for all of Europe, and it'll be good for the larger transatlantic community of which we are a part. If, however, Ukraine goes off course, that will be bad for all of us. The rationale for a steadfast policy of American support for Ukraine is just that simple. The fact is, while Ukraine still faces numerous challenges, it has already emerged as a force for stability and integration in Europe. It's done so through its courageous decision in 1993 to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty as a non-nuclear weapons state. In exchange for assurances worked out with the help of the United States, Ukraine, in that decision, enhanced its own security and it set a valuable example for the rest of the world. As a result of that landmark of Ukrainian wisdom, the whole world is a safer place today and it'll be safer still in the next century. Ukraine has shown similar statesmanship and strategic foresight by forging strong new ties with the West while maintaining and strengthening constructive relations with its neighbors to the East and, of course, to the North. Ukraine was the first new independent state to join the Partnership for Peace program in February 1994. This past summer, American, Ukrainian, Russian, and Polish troops trained together for peacekeeping operations on Ukrainian soil. And that training is already paying off. Today, American and Ukrainian soldiers are together in Bosnia, working side by side to deal with the first major threat to the peace of Europe since the end of the Cold War. And a Ukrainian-Polish peacekeeping battalion is now taking shape. Ukraine has also managed its complex relationship with Russia with prudence and balance, working hard to diffuse problems before they become crises. From time to time, when both parties have asked us to do so, the United States has tried to help, and it stands ready to do so again in the future. We in the United States government fully understand the difficulty that often attends the right decisions. Therefore, we will use every occasion, including this one here this evening, to reaffirm our determination to ensure that there is a proud and prominent place for Ukraine and the growing community of market democracies and in the institutions that undergird our common values, our common interests, and our common aspirations. My boss, Secretary Christopher, recently delivered a major speech on European security in Stuttgart, Germany. He laid out the President's strategic vision for a Europe that is increasingly stable, secure, prosperous, and democratic. A Europe that will be undivided for the first time in history. Let me quote just one part of what Secretary Christopher had to say about Ukraine in that speech. "A critical goal of the new Atlantic community," he said, "is to achieve Ukraine's integration with Europe." That statement will serve as a guiding principle for the United States in the months and years ahead. It means that we will support Ukraine's active participation in the Council of Europe and in the Organization on Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE. It means that we will continue to assist Ukraine in its efforts to join the World Trade Organization, and that we endorse Ukraine's interest in the Central European Free Trade Area, the European Union, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, which is the International Forum for Monitoring Economic Trends in Free Market Democracies. That same principle, that same commitment to Ukraine's integration into the Community of Nations will also help dictate our leadership of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO is and will remain essential to the evolution of a new post-Cold War Europe. A solid cooperative relationship between NATO and Ukraine is vital to European security. Now, as all of you know, NATO is preparing to take in new members. There will be concrete steps in that direction next year. We are determined that the process of NATO enlargement will serve the larger cause of peace, security, prosperity, democratization, and integration on the continent of Europe. This is more than just a matter of asserting a negative. It's more than just being determined that NATO enlargement not create new dividing lines or harm the legitimate security interests of any of the new democracies that are emerging from the old Soviet Empire. Rather, it is also a matter of asserting a positive proposition, namely that NATO will respect and enhance the security of the region as a whole and the security of all European states that deserve and aspire to integration. And that emphatically includes Ukraine. As a vigorous, path-breaking participant in the Partnership for Peace, Ukraine is already cooperating closely with NATO. We've laid the basis for a steadily developing relationship, a further cooperation and consultation. There is nothing to limit how that enhanced relationship might develop over time. Let me underscore two simple statements of fact and a principle. First, Ukraine, and only Ukraine, will decide what associations or memberships it aspires to in the future. And second, NATO, and only NATO, will decide whom to admit to its ranks. The watchwords of NATO enlargement bear repeating here. The process will continue to be deliberate, it'll be transparent, it will be open, it will be inclusive, and it will be respectful. Inclusive means that none of the emerging democracies is to be excluded. None means none. It means there will be no special categories for inclusion into NATO and none for exclusion from NATO. Respectful means that the rights and interests of all those states will be taken fully and properly into account in the way that enlargement occurs. Both of these principles apply to Ukraine. Now, how we apply those principles is one of the most important items on the ever-growing agenda of U.S.-Ukrainian cooperation and consultation. No subject has occupied more attention than European security in the dealings that Secretary Christopher and I have had with our friend, Foreign Minister Gennady Udovenko, or in the talks that Tony Lake and I recently had with Volodymyr Harbulin, the very able Secretary of the National Security and Defense Council. By the way, Foreign Minister Udovenko will be here again in just over a week for meetings with Secretary Christopher, Secretary Perry, and National Security Advisor Lake. The subject of Ukraine's important role in the building of a new Europe will also figure, along with a wide array of other topics, in a new channel that is opening between Washington and Kyiv. The U.S.-Ukraine Binational Commission, to be headed by President Kuchma and Vice President Gore. Now, I do not want to impose on your kind attention very much longer, nor do I want to delay the next stage of the embassy's hospitality. I've been here before for this event, and I know that there's going to be a lot of good cheer and some excellent adult beverages in due course. But I do want to make one final point. All of us in the Clinton administration, starting with the president and the vice president themselves, are optimistic. We are fundamentally optimistic about Ukraine's future, and I sense that you are too. One reason for our optimism is that Ukraine has come so far in such a short period of time. The United States' own historical experience should make us Americans humble, patient, persistent, and admiring when we look at Ukraine. After all, our own democracy has been a work in progress for 220 years. We must remember how long it's taken us to get it right. In fact, we're still working at it. The United States became a new independent state in 1776. When we celebrated the fifth anniversary of our own independence in 1781, we still had a very long way to go. It would take us another 6 years just to draft a constitution. Independent, democratic Ukraine accomplished that task before it turned five. In our own evolution as a civil society and a multi-ethnic democracy, it took us 89 years to abolish slavery, 144 years to give women the vote, and 188 to extend full constitutional protections to all citizens. All of which is to say that even by the accelerated, fast-forward standards of the modern world, Ukraine, at the tender age of five, has much of which to be proud, much to make it confident about the future, and much that we Americans can be proud to support, to applaud, and to join in celebrating for Ukraine's sake and ours. So happy birthday, Ukraine. Menochaya Lita, Ukraina. Thank you very much.
Mr. Talbot kindly consented to take 10 minutes worth of questions and answers, and I will abuse my privilege of being the host and ask the Washington Group newspaper editor, Yaro Bihun, for the first question.
Some members of the Ukrainian government, most recently Mr. Pinzenik on his recent visit here, had complained about the value-added tax that Russia has imposed on Ukrainian exports to Russia. And some say that this may fall under the trilateral agreement, which also calls for the non-use of economic pressures on Ukraine. But what is the U.S. government position on that?
Essentially, we regard economic relations between Ukraine and the Russian Federation, along with political and security relations, as matters to be worked out between those two countries. We think it is particularly important, obviously, that Ukraine and Russia have economic and commercial ties that are mutually beneficial. One reason that we have worked so hard to assist Ukraine in its accession to the WTO is to make sure that the policies of both countries are covered under the general rubric of international norms. We are, on the whole, quite optimistic about the way bilateral relations are developing between Ukraine and Russia, including in the economic area, but we're well aware, because we hear, of course, from both sides, that there are a lot of difficult issues that need to be dealt with. But the spirit of solving those problems seems to be there. Our own willingness to be of some help, as I mentioned in my remarks, depends on both parties asking us to assist. We will be happy to answer questions of a technical nature. But what we would really hope will happen is, first of all, that the two countries will work this out in a bilateral context, and second, that they will do so in a way that's in keeping with international economic and commercial norms. Yes, sir.
Adrian Karmazin, Voice of America. Mr. Talbot, as Ukraine looks for new sources of energy, particularly in the Mideast, how do you think Ukraine should approach the problem of dealing with what the U.S. considers rogue states, which be a natural source of energy for Ukraine? Should they not at all deal with these states, or what should be their problem?
I think there's no way to address this question without being fairly specific. The United States feels very strongly, as you know, that some countries, because of their international behavior, and also in some cases because of the nature of their domestic regime, really require a solid policy or response of isolation by the international community. And that to trade with those states, and here we're talking about such countries as Libya, Iran, Iraq, may carry with it the illusory benefit of economic payoff in the short term for countries that enter into partnerships with those countries. But over the long term, it will be bad for everybody. And the closer a country is to one of these rogue states, as we call it, the more dangerous it is to enter into a commercial relationship. And we have had a very frank and very open dialogue with Ukraine about its dealings or contemplation of dealings with some of these countries, just as we have had with other states in the region. Now, we recognize that our interests and our perceptions and our analysis are not always going to coincide with those of our partners. But the main thing is that we have an atmosphere in the relationship which allows us to address these problems frankly. I think we have that with Kyiv, as we do indeed with other capitals in the region. Yes, sir.
Ukraine saves the United States literally billions of dollars every year. 5 years ago, the Ukrainian people made the unilateral decision to leave the Soviet Union. Because of that, the United States has been able to reduce military forces in Eastern Europe by 200,000 American soldiers, plus civilians, plus family members. This saves the American taxpayer literally billions of dollars every year. Now, could you please explain why the Clinton administration has had difficulty in allowing the Senate to earmark aid for Ukraine in the current budget?
Yes, very simply. This administration, like other administrations before it, is against earmarks, generically, generally, across the board. We think that earmarks are a unwarranted infringement on the flexibility of the president, the chief executive, to make decisions about how the money allocated by the Congress is spent. This is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a position that opposes assistance to Ukraine. In fact, quite the contrary. The assistance that we have given to Ukraine exceeds the earmarks. So this is an issue of process, and it's an issue of principle. We have been able to do a little bit more than the earmarks would have required. Does that mean we're doing as much as we would like? No. But that's true, again, across the board. Secretary Christopher tries to make a point on every occasion when he speaks publicly, and I should do the same, of underscoring that our international affairs budget in general and our foreign assistance budget in particular is being kept on a starvation diet by the Congress. We are not able to do as much as we can to advance American interests in the former Soviet Union, in Central Europe, in any other part of the world. As a result of the very unwise, penny-wise, pound-foolish cuts in our foreign assistance programs and international programs. And this is an issue that we will eagerly and enthusiastically join with the new Congress, if we're around to do it, when the Congress comes in January. We would like to do more for Ukraine. We would like to do more for all of the countries, I might add, represented by their ambassadors here tonight. And we need to persuade the American people and their representatives in Congress that it's in the American interest to do so. Yes, sir, you've been very patient.
Science and technology in the entire Soviet Union is essentially a point. In particular, in Ukraine, science and technology was one of the very high level. And in view of the importance of science and technology in driving economic development, what plans does the U.S. have, particularly the Clinton administration have, for aiding science and technology in Ukraine?
Well, this is, of course, one of several areas that we would like to devote more resources to if we could persuade the Congress to make those resources available. And as we look to the future, we will try to do so. It's also an area in which money from the international financial institutions can also be extremely helpful. And the U.S. is trying to use its leadership position in the various multilateral development banks. It's also an area where private money can be very helpful. I heard George Soros's name used earlier as a participant in a conference that I gather the ambassador is at right now. Is that right, Yaroslav?
Right.
George Soros has used some of his own resources in this area, and we are always on the lookout for sources in the private sector to do the same thing. I certainly take your point, and incidentally, given President Kuchma's very considerable background and expertise in this area, this is a subject of particular interest to him, and he and President Clinton have talked about it and how they can do more in the future. Yes, sir.
Ukrainian media, you said that Ukraine have the gates for NATO open. What about the other Central and East European countries? What about Romania?
Romania, of course. Recently had an opportunity to meet with several high officials of the Romanian government, including Foreign Minister Melescanu just a week or 10 days ago. Romania is a country I actually know quite well. I lived in Central Europe in the early 1970s when President Ceausescu was in charge in Romania. The statements I made at the end of my remarks about extraordinary progress in a short period of time certainly apply to Romania. That is a country that has made remarkable progress in all respects, in developing its economy, in opening up a market, in putting in place democratic institutions, and working out respectful and constructive and peaceful relations with its neighbors. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't still some outstanding issues, as you know very well, including an issue between Romania and Ukraine. But Romania has definitely made progress in this area, and the door to NATO is open to Romania. And the bottom line of my message here tonight on this whole subject is that there is nobody that should be excluded from this. Now, this will be a self-selecting process in some ways. Countries have to decide for themselves, as a result of public opinion and the working of parliamentary democracy, whether they wish to apply for membership in NATO. Romania has made quite clear that it does want to apply, and it will be encouraged to keep moving in the right direction. Thanks. Yes, maybe one last question from the lady.
I have a question concerning the Chernobyl reactor. U.S. government and European countries are pressing Ukraine to shut off the reactor by 2,000 years, and the sarcophagus is leaking, and the Ukrainian government keeps on saying that they don't have the money to cover that one up and also to build the alternative sources of energy. And are the European countries and U.S. waiting for another disaster to happen, which will everybody will pay dearly, or is the money forthcoming, and when the Ukrainian government is acting so desperately? They say there are a lot of promises, but the money isn't forthcoming. Could you please tell us what amount and when, whether there are any plans concrete?
It's always the last question that gets you. I've learned that lesson so many times. When the master of ceremonies offers to cut it off, but of course it is. But you're gonna permit me, in a spirit of mutual assistance, to ask Carlos Pasquale to give you the specifics. But as I stressed in my remarks, because of precisely both the technical difficulty, the political courage, and the economic risk associated with this decision, the United States moved within the international community to make sure that $3 billion, am I correct? $3 billion is available, and Carlos Pasquale from the National Security Council will say a word or two on the exact timetable for the disbursement of that, perhaps.
Sure. Actually, if you can hear me, I'll just stand here. And in fact, on Sunday at 2:15, I'll be on a panel, and you can hear a longer explanation of this if you want to subject yourselves to it. But first of all, I think it's important to say that the decision to close Chernobyl by the year 2000 was a decision of President Kuchma, and that was a decision based on an understanding of the liability of the Chernobyl reactor continuing. And it's very important that people recognize that this is an internal Ukrainian decision. Now, to support that, the G7 countries came together to, in fact, try to provide the support, not just to address the small issue of Chernobyl, but in fact, to look at how Ukraine can restructure its entire power sector, make it more efficient, make it more viable, and in the course of that, addressing its energy needs. Now, in terms of the funding flows, much of that money is in fact flowing already. This year, Ukraine will get at least $500 million and possibly more. That includes $114 million for a power pump station that was approved a year ago, another $62 million which was provided by the EBRD for a power sector loan, $300 million which the World Bank, I think, just approved yesterday for a energy sector loan, another $300 million which is going to come before the board of the World Bank for a coal sector loan. And there are several other projects that are involved. In fact, yesterday there was an agreement with a nuclear safety account, which is managed by the EBRD, for another $112 million, which is focused on safety for Unit 1 of the Chernobyl plant. So in fact, many of these programs are moving directly together. There is specifically the issue of the sarcophagus, and this is a very sensitive issue, and one which is very emotional. Right now, there is not radiation which is leaking from the sarcophagus that has been a concern. There is an alert, in fact, even a few weeks back that had many people concerned, but I think everyone has come back and confirmed that that it is not leaking radiation. What we have engaged in with Ukraine and the other European and G7 countries is a process of defining a technical plan on how to, in fact, stabilize the sarcophagus and address the overall long-term problem of making it secure. The intent is that by the middle of November, the Ukrainian government and the donors will agree on that plan, and we're looking and hoping for by the end of the year or early in January for a pledging conference where donors will come together for financing. So that's a short story, and I can tell you a lot more on Sunday if you like, but we regard this as an absolutely crucial issue and are very much committed to making sure that the money flows quickly.
I'm really genuinely glad that you did ask the question. First, because it's an important question and deserves an answer of that quality, and second, and I mean this very seriously, because this has given me a chance to show off the quality of expertise and intellect that is at work in our government on behalf of U.S.-Ukrainian relations. I'm just sorry nobody asked a question that I could have had Dr. Deutsch answer. But maybe next time. Thank you.
I would like to thank everybody, and I think it's time for a well-earned reception to come.
Thank you.